For the benefit of the Tate Ministry, my name is Solveig Chessa. And this session, I believe, is Namibia, the Long Road to Freedom. And what we are doing tonight, or what my assignment is to cram three of the presentations from last week into one tonight. So that we'll be covering a lot of ground in a relatively short period of time, and I want to kind of follow along with my notes and condense them as we go. But please, just because we're going quickly doesn't mean that you can't interrupt at any time. This is a good small group, and we can please ask questions or interrupt or disagree or tell me it doesn't make sense or whatever. I work with National Namibia Concerns, which is an organization that grew out of Wartburg Seminary about 15 years ago. Since 1971, Wartburg Seminary has had Namibian pastors doing graduate work there. And when they first came, they had to kind of tell us how to pronounce the name of their country and show us where it was. Namibia is not a country that many people have heard of. In fact, I think in the United States, it's mainly the Lutherans who have heard of Namibia. And one of the reasons for that is that probably 55% of the people in Namibia are Lutheran. So we have a real, real close connection. Our Namibia Concerns Committee grew from seven members. Until now, we have a mailing list of over 11,000. It has grown to be the largest grassroots education and advocacy group in the world that is dealing with Namibia. Largest in terms of members on the mailing list and smallest in terms of finances. So we will very soon be going out of business. We plan to, we hope, publish one more newsletter. With independence in Namibia, which came last March, the funding from the United Nations and from other international organizations just dropped off immediately. But tonight, I wanted just to give a little picture of the country of Namibia. And this map, the lighting here, and casts a lot of shadows on this map, but what you are looking at is this very large country of Namibia, which is about twice as big as California. It's located on the southwest coast of Africa. And one of the interesting features of Namibia is its geography. At the time that the European nations, Portugal and others, were sailing down around the African continent and colonizing Africa, Namibia was protected for almost 100 years because of its geography. Running along the whole coastline here is the Namib Desert. It runs inland for about 50 miles. It's considered to be one of the oldest, if not the oldest, deserts in the world. We had some geologists here last week that were interested in that. And it's a very inhospitable place for explorers. They came down the coast and took a look at what was there to land. In a couple instances, they did try to make a landing, but it's very difficult, and they weren't sure that it was worth it, looking at this expansive desert. And it's also difficult. This along here is called the Skeleton Coast because of the number of ships that did attempt to make a landing, and for some reason, it's difficult to do. Looking just quickly at the boundaries of Namibia, the only rivers that flow year-round in Namibia are the ones that form its borders, north and south. down here in the south, it's a very wild stretch of the Orange River. And again, that served as kind of a shield. It's interesting, the word Namib, for the Namib Desert, means a shield or protector. And that's exactly the way it functioned. Then along the east, you have the Kalahari Desert, vast stretches here. Up in this area, you have the Okavango Swampland, which again is not conducive to explorers. In the north, you have the Kavango River, the Kunene River in the west, and the Okavango River running along to the east. Now, lots of times people ask me why that strip, why this funny looking panhandle sticks out there. And this is jumping ahead of the story a little bit. But the reason is that when Africa was divided up by the European powers, they drew boundary lines very arbitrarily. For example, here in the northern boundary there cuts through one ethnic group that some of them suddenly became Portuguese Angolans and the others were now German Southwest Afrikaners. But Germany claiming what we call Namibia also had claimed what they then called Tanganyika over on the other side of Africa. And they were hoping to find a water route. They thought the Okavango River looked promising and they were going to find a water route from one of their colonies to the other. The trouble is right at the point there, you run into Victoria Falls, which is a big drop if you're going in one direction and almost impossible to sail up. So that attempt was abandoned, but the boundaries have existed. When we think of the early history of Namibia, you know, people wonder, well, what kinds of peoples were in Namibia before the Europeans came? The Europeans really came to Namibia in the early years of the 1800s. And we'll talk more about that later, but let's just, you know, one of the myths that South Africa propagated for so long was that the country was empty when they had come, and that there were no people in southern Africa. This certainly wasn't the case. In Namibia, in the center of the country, was a group of people called Herero, and they did cattle farming, beef, or yeah, cows they raised. Up in the north, and again down in this area, were the Nama people, and they were sheep and goat herders. In the far north were the, and that's the far north there is really the best farmland in the country because of that river. Now if you look at my slides tomorrow night, you will hardly recognize it for farmland because it is so sandy and desolate looking. It's not your Iowa topsoil. But because there was the rivers and farming was possible in the north, and the group in the north, which really combines six or seven kind of ethnic groups, but the overall group is called the Ovambo, and they were very settled in terms of agriculture, in terms of their community life. They also did trading. They were already mining the copper and trading products not only with other Namibian groups but north up into the rest of Africa. Then over in the Kalahari Desert and also out in the Namib Desert were the San people. They are also called Bushmen. They are considered the oldest residents of this part of southern Africa. In fact, the name for the San people in a couple of the Namibian languages is the Ancient Ones. They were there early, and there are rock paintings and a lot of interesting records from the Ancient Ones. The first recorded arrival of the Portuguese was a landing right here in Swakopmund in 1485. And they immediately returned to their boats. Took one look and left. And then in 1486, the explorer, again Portuguese, Diaz, is that how we say it? Bartolomé Diaz? I've forgotten. Sailed around the Cape, you know, around past the Cape of Good Hope. He came back up and landed here and erected a stone cross and left. And that was it, basically, until at least in the 1700s. These folks lived in peace much longer than the other African groups. But by the late 1700s, pressures from South Africa, because the Dutch East Indies Company had settled down at what's now Cape Town, and was pushing northward, and that they pushed ahead of them, the San people, the Nama people, and a group of people called the Bastars, which are a mixed race group of people. Let's see. Our history in Namibia begins really with the arrival, again coming into the central part of the country, the missionaries from the Rhenish Missionary Society in Germany landed about 1840. And they worked in the center of the country for the next few years. In 1864, and this is, you know, it's a really sobering thing for us to realize that it was the first people who came bringing the message of the gospel to Namibia. It was the same people who first drove the Namibians from their land and robbed them of their cattle. And as early as 1864, this Rhenish missionary group sent word back to Germany to Prussia, to please send troops. And that's something that is a source of a lot of bitterness on the part of the Namibian people. And with the troops, or shortly after Prussian troops began to arrive, German merchants began to arrive also. There's one particularly infamous German whose last name was Luderitz, and he came in about the early 1880s. He knew that there were tremendous minerals in South Africa. He suspected there were in Namibia. And as early as 1883, I believe it was, he said, "Our aim is to leave this territory a gaping hole." So it was really right up front with the priorities. There was very little concern about the Namibian people. And in fact, what Luderitz and other Germans did was to pit ethnic group against ethnic group. For example, he bought a bunch of land along here and in fact swindled the Nama chief out of much of his land. They paid for it with old rifles, which was this. Not only did the intruders really increase the tensions between the ethnic groups, but they introduced guns, which then made any sort of border dispute much more deadly. In 1884, at a conference in Berlin, Africa was divided up according to among the European countries, and that's when the official border was drawn, and that's when Namibia became a colony of Germany, a possession of Germany. With the exception of Walvis Bay, their only deep water port had been claimed earlier by Great Britain, and so they did not give up that their claim to the port, but the rest of Namibia was German, and that's significant. You have to remember that, but that was British, the rest was German. Well, in 1904, the Namibian people discovered with dismay, and the parallels between the experiences of the Indians in this country and the black Namibians is quite striking. The Namibians began to discover that this new group of people were not the ones they wanted to deal with. And in 1904, a leader of the Hereros by the name of Samuel Maharero sent a message to the leader of the Namas down here, and among other things said, these Germans keep shooting our people for no reason. So let us join together and push them out. The messenger never did reach the Nama chief, and so the Hereros went into battle in January 1904 by themselves, really, against the German forces. It was a completely uneven match, and by August of that year the Hereros were completely defeated. They'd been pushed eastward, decimated, and it was at that time that a German general by the name of von Trotta issued an extermination order, ordering that all Hereros, men, women, children, armed or unarmed, should be shot. And there's just a chilling translation that I saw years ago, of all places, in the Minneapolis Public Library, and I don't know how to find it again, but a translation of the reports that this general was sending back to the German government and telling about the progress in the war. And one of the things he wrote was that they should be shot, the remnants of the Herero Nation should be pushed eastward, ever eastward, until nature completes what the German army has begun. In other words, the Herero stragglers were forced into the desert where they died. It was very successful. It's estimated there were 80,000 Hereros at the beginning of the war, and two or three years later, there were probably 8,000. Just a genocide. And then the poor Nama folk down here, too late and too little, got into the battle, and they lost about 35% of their population. So it was a tremendous bloodbath in the early years of this century in Namibia. Questions to this point? You can take a big breath there. I should have mentioned, one of the things I didn't mention was, while the German Rhenish Missionary Society was working here in the central part of the country, one of their early leaders, a man by the name of Hahn, traveled north, and this is a vast distance. Anyway, he discovered there's all kinds of people up there in the north, far more than the German missions could begin to work with. So he sent out a call, and the Finnish Mission Society responded. In about 1850, 1860, they began to have missionaries in the north. And thankfully, their record, while it was still a case of European colonizers in a sense, they weren't as closely linked. They had no army, they had no soldiers, and they didn't have the merchants that had followed along in the south. And so their record of relationships with the Ovambo people is much, much better than what was going on in the South. Well, let's see. Then came the First World War. And South Africa, of course, was a part of the British Empire. And they were asked to invade Namibia, which they did in 1915. And many, many black Namibians fought with the South African army. For one reason, the South Africans presented themselves as the liberators. And boy, the Namibians thought, you know, here is help in driving out the Germans, in getting control again of our own country. And South Africa, really at the time, they had published in Britain a blue book that told the atrocities of the Germans against the Namibians. It was as though South Africa really did come as liberators initially. It didn't take long though, because only 2 years later, in 1917, they went north and, along with the forces of Portugal, captured and killed the last Ovambo king, or the ruler that was so much admired. And I have just a little woodcut here that a Namibian artist made, and I just came across the other day this paragraph. Then, it is fated that Hainbili will die, and his successors likewise will perish. It is the strangers who will live in our country. And this was said by a prophet in the court of Hainbili, who was ruling the Kwanyama in northern Namibia and Angola. Remember, they were across that border there. From about 1811, he founded the dynasty that ended with Mandume's death at the hands of South Africa in 1917. And certainly a prophet worthy of the name. But anyway, South Africa lost no time in not only continuing the practices of the Germans over against the black Namibians, but enforcing them and writing them into law. From the first day that South Africa was in Namibia, they tended to occupy Namibia as though it were a part of South Africa. And so they, very early on, by 1920-21, they had passed, enacted a pass law, you know, requiring blacks to have papers that would allow them, that very much controlled their movement. Very early they established, and someplace again I have seen this and I'm still trying to retrace it, what they called a reservation system. And in some writing I have seen it was directly linked with what they had knew had happened in the United States. It's called reservations, and you have the people, you force them to live on reservations. And so that helped, that happened in Namibia. It was, as in South Africa, it was the worst possible land that was given to the native people for their so-called homelands. In Namibia, in many cases, it did not correspond at all. I mean, to call it homeland was just crazy. This is true in South Africa, too. It does not necessarily have any correlation with where you or your ancestors had lived. And one of the tremendous insults, really, that word is too weak, was that the Herero homeland was put right on the desert where so many of them had died years earlier. By 1923, South Africa had passed laws that kept only 5% of the land in Namibia was reserved for black Namibians. 95% went to South Africans or to Germans. And because of this, South Africa greatly encouraged settlers, and the number of white settlers in Namibia had doubled by 1926. The other thing that, another feature of South African apartheid that they instituted in Namibia was this idea of contract labor. Since in Namibia, after the Herero massacre, most of the people, the largest percentage of the people, lived in this far north. And South Africans needed people to run the mines, right? The industry, there was a big fishing industry off the coast, and then the diamond mines, and much later uranium mines, and so forth. They needed cheap labor, also for the farms that are spread through the highlands. And so they developed a system of contract labor where men were recruited in the north, they were trucked down to the south, they were evaluated as to their health, what kind of work they could do, and then they were sent to their workplace in a metal bracelet with a date on it, put on their wrist, and they could not leave that place of work until that date came, and it was usually at least 11 months, sometimes longer. And if they were caught away from that was a crime. They were imprisoned at best. So it was very much like slave labor for the Namibian people. And as a result of living under that for so many years, the health and so forth of the Namibians declined. Even today, average life expectancy is in the 40s. And even today, in many places, nearly one child in five dies of malnutrition before its fifth birthday. And that in a country that is full of tremendous resources. It's just been... But the Namibian people, for all these years, lived virtually as slaves in their own country. Now, from time to time, one should never get the idea that there was no resistance. I talked about the German Herero War. From time to time, there were attempts on the part of Namibian people to rebel, to revolt against what was happening, but always these were crushed. And in 1958, a group of contract laborers, actually who came from the north of Namibia and were working about down here in Cape Town in the fisheries, got together and started the Ovambo People's Congress. They were working in a fish cannery down in Cape Town, and that was the beginnings of what then came to be SWAPO, Southwest Africa People's Organization, the main liberation group that has fought for so many years, struggled for independence. I think the years 1959 and 1960 were extremely significant in the history of Namibia. A couple important things happened at that time. First of all, in the capital city here of Windhoek, the white people were looking around, and you know, there were getting to be more and more of them, and they needed some more nice housing. And in Namibia, as in South Africa, the black people have not been allowed to live within the city limits. The whites lived in the city limits, the blacks lived out in townships. And here they had in Windhoek what they called the old location. The location was where the blacks were living, and it was a beautiful hillside, actually. It was close to where they worked. It was nothing but shacks, but the decision was made to remove forcibly the black population from the location. And they were sent to three different places. The so-called coloreds, you know, in South Africa throughout has used the tactic of divide and conquer, you know, with all these racial classifications and pitting one group against the other. But the so-called colored were to be moved to one township called Comestall. The blacks were to go to another area that they called Katutura, which means we will never stay here. This will not be our home, but it was. And then the older people, or people too ill to work, were loaded on trucks and trucked out to the so-called homelands. And a terrible scene. I've had Namibian students talk about what it was like to see their grandparents loaded into the truck and taken away. And that, in December, when all this was a regular effort, and several people were killed, and it provided a unifying situation. And the Ovambo People's Organization was established then in 1960 as the Southwest Africa People's Organization. So it wouldn't represent just the folks in the north, it would be the main political party. And they tried for 6 years to effect change politically. But in what the other thing that happened in 1960, I have to mention, and that is the election for the first time of a black bishop as to lead one of our Lutheran churches. It was Bishop Owala, leader of the church in the north, and that's 350,000 at least Lutherans in the north. And this was very significant because the attitude of the church slowly began to change. I mean, it had been silent at best in the face of what was happening to the Namibian people. And with the election of Bishop Owala, this began to change. Well, in 1966, the United Nations declared that South Africa had violated its sacred trust, that it was not caring for the well-being of the people of Namibia. And they announced that the United Nations would be responsible for Namibia. During 1966, also there was a very strange decision by the International Court of Justice. The question of Namibia's occupation had been brought to them, and after months of deliberation, they decided on a technicality that they wouldn't rule on it. And this was a tremendous disappointment to the Namibian people. They had had such confidence that the justice of their cause would have been upheld. Well, the court just didn't rule on it. And at that time, SWAPO decided to begin the military. They felt, we have to free ourselves. We must liberate ourselves. In 1971, the International Court of Justice did rule on the question. Apparently, it was properly brought before them. And they ruled that South Africa was there in Namibia illegally and must withdraw immediately. Well, South Africa, of course, rejected this ruling. And they turned to Bishop Owala for agreement. They were so sure that this black bishop and his black church would do what they were told. And so they asked him to issue a statement that he agreed with South Africa, that the Namibian people really wanted South Africa to continue to administer their land. Well, not only did he not, he said to them, I need to consult with my church council. And what they did, a number of church leaders, including Pastor Zephaniah Kameta, which maybe some of you have heard when he was here at Holden. And Bishop Owala and others drafted an open letter to the South African Prime Minister. And in it, they rejected the continued dominance of South Africa. They quoted the international human rights ordinances. And not only that, they said, what South Africa is doing in our country is contrary to the gospel. And this was read, not only did they release it to the press, but they had it read in every Lutheran congregation. And now I should have said that Namibia is an amazing country in terms of the level of the Christianity. It's in the 90%. And they're not just Christian on the book. They are in church on Sunday morning, for hours in church. Our kids used to walk into the church service and look immediately at the hymn board. And if there were more than 10, they knew this was going to be a bad one. But Namibian people suddenly realized here that the church, their leaders are saying what South Africa is doing is wrong, and we have the support of the church in resisting South Africa. And I am told that the difference in the climate was absolutely magnetic. I mean, it was just electrifying. Overnight, the idea came that maybe we can unite and do something about South Africa oppression. Okay, and I also should add that the Episcopalian and the Roman Catholic parishes read the letter then the following week, and so it was everywhere. In 1973, the United Nations recognized SWAPO as the sole authentic voice of the Namibian people. And this was really unusual. The UN had never before recognized a so-called guerrilla group as the legitimate government, in a sense, of the people. In 1978, a couple things happened. First of all, there was in the United Nations a United Nations Resolution 435, and it really was a watered-down compromise version of what had been passed the year before. But South Africa had refused to agree to the one the year before, and the United States had moved in and arranged this compromise. It was calling for a free election in Namibia, but the difference between 1978 and 1977 was in the 77 version, the South Africans would withdraw and the UN would conduct free elections. We arranged a compromise, allowing for free elections but run by South Africa. And that was something that looked more and more foolish as we came up to them, but it worked. Anyway, in 1980, this Resolution 435 had been agreed to, and all the conditions were met and so forth, and there was great hope that this is finally now going to happen. And then the United States took off. Nixon had taken office, and Reagan. And his negotiators talked with South Africa and said, we would like inserted as a precondition that there can be no free elections in Namibia until all the Cubans have left Angola. This was a tremendous letdown, a feeling on the part of the Namibian people of complete betrayal by the United States. They felt they were being held hostage by this U.S. foreign policy agenda that really did not involve them. And indeed, It was, they were hostage. I mean, it delayed the independence for almost 10 years. South Africa continued to build up its military presence in Namibia until there were more than 100,000 soldiers, and that was one soldier every 12 Namibians. In the north of Namibia, where virtually all the fighting took place in this heavily populated area, it was one soldier for every 4 Namibian people. So that gives you an idea. You could not look anywhere during those days without seeing weapons or tanks or Caspers or planes. It was absolutely unbelievable. Now, suddenly, because it came very, very quickly in 1988, South Africa agreed to peace talks on Namibia. And it came so quickly, it almost caught folks off guard. Why did South Africa suddenly change after all these years of complete intransigence? Well, there were a number of reasons. One is the mothers in South Africa were, it was a little bit like Vietnam. The mothers, the family started saying, we don't want our boys, because the 18-year-old white boys in South Africa were being sent to Namibia, to the border. And whereas a few years earlier, it was just a rally cry, support the boys on the border, enough of those young men were getting killed that South Africa began, the people of South Africa began to question why and whether this was really worth it. And so that was one factor. A second factor was that in Angola, the arms embargo, I think, played a role in this. South Africa lost control of the skies. The Russian supplied planes were better, faster, or whatever than theirs. And in the fall of 1987, South Africa had announced that it was going to drive up north into Angola and capture a certain strategic place, and they would do it immediately. I mean, I'm not sure why the announcement was made, but it was to be a big triumph for South Africa, military victory. And it never happened. I mean, the troops, the battle for a place called Quito Carnaval, which is in Angola, went on and on and on. And South Africa couldn't capture it. So that was very disturbing to them. We were at that time in Harare, and we suddenly began hearing rumors, nothing of course in the newspaper, but rumors among the Namibian exiles, the South African exiles, that South Africa was ready to negotiate because a whole group of white South African soldiers had been trapped in Angola. This push had gone too quickly up. This Angolan army and the Cubans in Swapo came down and had cut off the retreat for a large number of white South Africans. One of the amazing things was at home in South Africa, the army was not required to report the deaths of black draftees or enlisted people. It was not required to report the deaths of enlisted whites, officers and so forth, but it had to report the deaths of these conscripts. And that's what was building the feeling at home, no more boys on the border, and here they were stuck with a sizable number up there in Angola. And so that prodded them to talk. The other thing is the South African economy has really been battered, and the war in Namibia was costing more than $1 million a day, and the question is how long can we afford that? So, and another thing that had happened in Namibia at that time, and I think that also must be taken into consideration, and that is efforts of the young people in Namibia. You know, most of the Namibian kids who are able to go to high school must go to boarding schools because the transport is non-existent. And so there were Namibian kids in boarding schools, and what South Africa had done was in some cases put soldiers right in the schools, in other cases they built their camps right next to the school so that if SWAPO would attack, it would run the risk of killing the students. And in 1988, the students, starting our Lutheran High School in the north and a couple other high schools, the kids went on out on strike and were boycotting the school. And this quickly spread throughout the country till there were 40,000 kids who were demanding that the South African forces be removed from their schools. And I know I spoke with Bishop Dumeni in May that year, and he said this: the kids have united the country in ways that we could not. There was a tremendous pulling together across the various ethnic lines. He said, how parents say, how can we not support our children? They have been this courageous. We have to support them. So I think all of those factors went into the signing of the peace accord in December 1988. And that set in motion this whole UN plan for independence beginning in April and the culminating now in March this year with the independence of Namibia. The UN plan called first of all for the repatriation of the refugees. There were thousands and thousands of Namibians in exile, probably at least 60,000, and in a population of less than 1.5 million. That was quite a number of folks in exile. The United Nations asked the churches to arrange for the repatriation, and we can feel such pride in the Council of Churches in Namibia and our sister churches there, because the UN has said never have so many people been brought home and repatriated and resettled in such an efficient and smooth manner. About 43,000 Namibians began flocking back, special flights from the neighboring countries and into reception centers that were church institutions that the UN had provided, how many hundred tents and so forth. It was a tremendous thing. So the first thing was the repatriation, then the voter registration. And again, remember, South Africa was allowed to stay in power during all this time. So they wrote the registration laws. They monitored the registration of voters. It was a tremendous, they printed the ballot. When the elections happened, they counted the votes. But what happened was a tremendous amount of support from the rest of the world in terms of watching what was happening. Surely there were irregularities, to put it mildly. One of the things that South Africa wrote into the registration laws was a clause that allowed thousands and thousands of white South Africans to vote in the Namibian election. It's estimated that about 11,000 white South Africans voted. There were tours. You could get a free bus ride to one of the border towns to register, and then 3 months later you could get a free bus ride back to vote. Or if you had a little more money, you could fly into Windhoek and register. And it was an amazing thing. On the election Okay, but anyway, Namibians registered. They had been waiting 150 years. And even though it looked like it was futile, they registered. And the question is, you know, one tremendous job, how do you show people how to vote when they've never voted in their lives and 60% at least are illiterate? They cannot read the ballot they're going to vote on. We have some friends in Denver, four young boys who went into exile when they were 13 years old. Without their families, they went into the bush and into Angola, and they have literally been raised by the United Nations and SWAPO. And these four guys were determined. Now, when they could go home, they went home and worked around the clock in voter education. You know, and they would tell amazing stories about one of the things when South Africa printed the ballot. There's 11 different parties, and South Africa let these parties choose SWAPO symbols as their symbol. So there'd be the name of the party and then a clenched fist, or the name of the party and a flame. Well, both of those have been used by SWAPO. So it was a deliberate attempt to confuse the electorate who couldn't read. But these boys said, we would have to tell them, you know, you vote for the whole figure, because on the ballot, SWAPO had maybe from here up with the arm up. There were others that just had the fist. Don't just vote for the fist, the whole body. And then you have to make an X, correct? But in Namibia, an X is called a goat. And a check stands for a cow, you know, if you're not. And so it was really confusing to people, because they wanted to give their very best to SWAPO, right? So they'd vote cow. And these kids told of older women, the grandchildren would sit there and practice and practice and practice. No, grandma, no, you need to write a goat. Not a cow, and it can't be big, it can't go out the box, and you know, just incredible voter education. 97% of eligible voters, of registered voters, voted, which is unbelievable.
Looks like we need a lesson from the Namibians.
Well, it's amazing. There were 5 days of voting, and they would walk for hours to get to the voting place. And then wait in lines that were up to a mile long in the hot sun, but they were determined to vote. And one of my friends who was there said what was most touching to her were all the old people voting. People who knew they were not going to live too much longer, but they were there to vote on behalf of, and for the sake of their kids. The South Africans flew into Windhoek, and who's running this election, of course, the authorities set up a special voting place at the airport so they could catch the next flight back. They wouldn't, well, some Namibians discovered, you know, got wind of this, of course, and so they got in line out at the airport. You didn't have to vote. That was a real weakness. You didn't have to vote where you'd registered. So all these black Namibians got in the line, and folks missed their return flights. And the second day of elections, there was a separate line for the white South Africans so they could make their flights. Well, by the third day, the UN and other observers had put an end to that. But it was just, we had pictures in another newsletter of this crowd at the airport voting. Let's see, SWAPO won 41 of the 72 seats. It won something like 99% of the votes cast in the north were for SWAPO. We were watching on our modem and on our fax machine, and the first results that came in, it looked like a terrible day for SWAPO in Namibia, and we were just thinking that all these things had worked for South Africa, and then came the Ovambo vote, and it was overwhelming. And so the Namibians, if Swapo had gotten 2/3 of the vote, their constitution would have been the constitution. They could have placed their own constitution. I think it was much better that they didn't, because they have had to negotiate, they've had to give on some points, and they've, I think, felt a little more accountable. And the constitution that was produced is considered one of the most progressive, certainly on the continent of Africa. It, you know, it has very strong protection for human rights. It has written into it the exclusion of capital punishment. It has written in a protection for the rights of women. It's considered just kind of a model constitution. It will be interesting to see now in the next few years how this how it develops. But the Independence Day was March 21st this year, and that happens to be the anniversary in South Africa. On March 21st, 1960, there was a terrible massacre, the Sharpeville Massacre. And I don't know whether the Namibian Independence Day was chosen to commemorate that, but a friend of mine, a lawyer who has worked for 40 years on Namibian independence, wrote, "From this day forth, the contrasting events of the Sharpeville Massacre on March 21st, 1960, and Namibia's independence on March 21st, 1990, will become indelible images of apartheid's savage cruelty and its inevitable defeat." And it's a, I think it's an exciting moment for Namibia. Last week I spent an hour on the problems that lie ahead. You know, certainly the very, very difficult task of nation building begins now. As I mentioned, the illiteracy rate of 60%. I've read that 90% of the teachers that have taught in the black schools are unqualified. So there's a tremendous educational need, and that's one of the things that the new government has said has to be a priority. Land redistribution, you know, it's still only about 5 or 8% of the land that has been available, of the decent land. There was a saying in Namibia, if it has water, it's white man's land, because theirs surely did not. Unemployment is around 30 to 40%, and that certainly has, that problem has been increased by the return of all the exiles and the return of all the soldiers. So we have this vast, crime is increasing in Namibia. There's just, that's a definite, what to do with all these unemployed people. Housing is a tremendous need in Namibia. There just isn't housing. What else? AIDS is increasing. That had been absolutely unknown, or almost, maybe just a handful of cases. And now with the return of so many exiles from parts of Africa that are very much affected by AIDS, that is going to be something that, and I am pleased that the government is immediately saying this is a serious problem that we have to work in. One of the problems in Zimbabwe was that the government refused for a long time to allow any discussion of that problem. What else? You know, basically they are faced with the problem of building a nation out of the ashes that have been left to them. One of the good things, oh, and that is without any deep water port, because South Africa, since this was British way back then, South Africa refused to consider Walvis Bay as part of Namibia. So they are sitting there with all of the military equipment and soldiers, or much of it, went into Walvis Bay. So that's a...
How big is that area?
I don't know. It's very, very small. I mean, half an hour drive through, kind of. But one of our friends said, some people have asked, what, you know, can we send aid? Can we send clothing? Can we send books? And recently we were told, don't send, money is fine, and people are fine, but they are discovering they're being charged double import. They pay customs when it hits Walvis Bay, and then half an hour later they pay customs to take it from Walvis Bay into Namibia. So that's a problem. Are there other questions? This was an awful lot. This was two sessions crammed together.
Yeah, I have a question. What's to keep the free Namibians now from just simply surrounding that little freshwater port and saying out?
Well, they're trying to do it through negotiation. Again, because South Africa's military might far outweighs theirs, but they are also trying to negotiate that question. And I think they feel, some of us wondered why SWAPO didn't insist on that being spelled out in the peace accords. But I think they feel there is enough international support and probably even international legal precedent that pretty soon South Africa will have to give it over. But there's a tremendous fishing industry off the coast there, one that has been overfished for decades. And one of the reasons for getting control of Walvis Bay is to set, they want to set